Unholy cow. Exodus chapter 32. For nearly 8 chapters, we have been on the top of Mount Sinai with Moses and the Lord, and it has been glorious. Unlike our prayers, where we do most of the talking, that just wasn't the case for Moses. It was the Lord doing all the talking, almost 40 days of the Lord doing all the talking, and Moses incapable of getting a word in edgewise. This wasn't about what Moses had to say. This was about what the Lord had to say. And I'm sure Moses just loved that. I'm sure we wouldn't argue with that if the Lord chose to do that in our prayer times. Just hush us and shush us and say, let me speak. We'd love that, I think. I'm pretty sure Moses enjoyed that. It was a very special occasion because God, who had been fairly silent for centuries and centuries, all of a sudden is chatty. You wouldn't expect it. But the Lord is talking up a storm, giving instruction to Moses. But tonight in our study, we're all coming down from the mountaintop with Moses. And we're coming into the valley below, where we're going to find out that what was going on the mountaintop wasn't necessarily going on in the valley below. There were two different things happening. And it wasn't just the earthly altitude difference, but there was a spiritual altitude difference between the mountaintop experience of Moses and what was happening down in the valley below. Moses was enjoying a gabby God, a chatty God. He was learning all about God. He was hearing about all that God wants for the spiritual life of the nation of Israel. He is truly having a mountain-high experience, but down below, it's drastically different. There's a group of people, a nation of people, that have agreed to follow the Lord, and they did that knowing very little about the Lord. And it is their burning desire to know more about the Lord and get started in this worship of Yahweh thing, and it is eating them alive. And so impatience will ultimately drive them to grave error. And this is pretty much a regular experience. You know, you go away on a retreat with the Lord, a camp, a convention somewhere, a conference somewhere. Maybe it's just a retreat out in a cabin. You're spending time with the Lord. It's a mountaintop experience for you. The Lord's blessing you. You're getting close to the Lord. Things are happening. Things are changing in you. But then you got to come back down from the mountaintop. Have you ever noticed this? And you get back home, and though you're changed, and though you're maturing and growing, the people back home are still, well, maybe miserable like they were before. Because you realize, hey, what was going on with me and my mountain high experience wasn't happening back here. This is the valley. Life was still plugging along here. I had a unique experience, and sometimes there's a mess to clean up when that happens. At least for Moses, this changes his plan for this 32nd chapter of the book. Chapter 32 could have been about Moses debriefing, the nation being informed, and the nation getting to work on the many things that the Lord wanted them to build. But instead, this is a major setback for the nation. Instead of chapter 32 being about instruction and movement on the part of the nation, instead, the Lord has to launch into a 3-chapter effort to clean up the mess that is below, all because of their impatience. What they weren't good at was waiting on the Lord. And if I could just give you one encouragement in this introduction, it would be this: learn quick to wait long on the Lord, and learn it well. Let's begin reading in verse 1. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods." Now, have you ever heard a more absurd request in your entire life? Come, make us gods. And I think to myself, how low must your concept of God be in order to make a request like this? You surely can't have your hopes up too much for this God. I mean, If this is the God that's supposed to be meeting your needs and helping you, you can't have very high expectations if you're the one creating your God. What's that God going to do for you? Reading on, come make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, hey, credit where credit is due, but they say, we do not know what has become of him. I mean, he hasn't called. He doesn't write. No text. He hasn't even made any social media status updates. We don't know what's going on with him. Why is he still on the payroll? And so they decide that maybe Moses, who's up there in age, let's face it, let's be real, maybe he didn't make the trek. Maybe Moses is dead. And so they move on to the assistant pastor. The assistant pastor is promoted. Verse 2, and Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. And before we read any further, I would just like to say that, yes, the nation of Israel was wearing the jewelry that they had spoiled from the Egyptians when they were delivered out of Egypt, and there was no problem with that whatsoever. And neither does the Bible ever teach that it is a sin for a Christian to wear jewelry, but as we know, there are some legalistic and works-based groups that teach that wearing jewelry is a sin. And that is because they misunderstand the New Testament passages, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 3, 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 9. And they misunderstand what's going to happen in the next chapter, because it's true, in the next chapter, the Lord is going to say, do not put your jewelry back on. Just wait. Let me figure out what to do with you. And we're going to talk about that next week and hopefully clear up any outstanding misconceptions you may have about the topic. But suffice it to say for right now, when you sin with your jewelry, it's only reasonable to expect that the Lord would ground you from your jewelry. And that is exactly what takes place here. And keep in mind also that they've only brought so much jewelry with them, and that is the metal that is going to be melted down to make the things that the Lord wants to make for the tabernacle, and they've already wasted a good bit of it making a stupid golden calf. So whether jewelry is right for you or not, whether it is holy or unholy, like so many things in the Bible, it's neutral until you do what you're going to do with it. It is all about what that jewelry is for. In this case, and yes, this is a little bit of a spoiler alert, but is your jewelry becoming your God? Are you wearing your jewelry out of pride? Are you doing it to get a date? Or are you using that outward adornment to adorn what the Lord has already made beautiful inside? If that's why you're doing it, then I can guarantee you the Lord is A-okay with your jewelry wearing. There are negative passages about it in the Bible. There are positive passages about it in the Bible. There are neutral passages. It all depends on the purpose of it. But let me just bring you back to a passage we've quoted a handful of times. I'm going to quote it again because now we're looking at it in a different context. This is Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10. And the prophet Isaiah says in verse 10, I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he has clothed me with the garments of salvation. You remember this verse? He has covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with ornaments, and as a bride adorns herself with her jewels. So that is the prophet Isaiah comparing the gift of his salvation and the imputed righteousness of the Lord on his life to bridal jewelry. So it is seen there as a positive thing. Jewelry, like most things, is neutral. And whether you make it godly or ungodly, it all depends on the thoughts and intentions of your heart. Now, certainly with the nation of Israel here in chapter 32 and chapter 3, it's what they did with their jewelry that angered the Lord. That's what gets them in trouble here. So let's take a look. Verse 3, So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, verse 4. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool, and he made a molded calf. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt," verse 5. So when Aaron saw it, that is, once he saw the finished product, he was quite impressed with it. And he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." If you're a note taker, underline that word, Lord. You'll notice it's in all caps. Do you remember what that means from our Genesis study? That means this is a translation of the name of God, the proper name of God. When you see Lord in all caps, that is the tetragrammaton, YHWH, or Yahweh. He uses the name of Yahweh for this golden calf. Reading on, verse 6. Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And believe me, that is not talking about ping pong or billiards. We are talking about naughty play here. This is the Hebrew nation turning to inappropriate partying and revelry. The rest of the passage is going to make that clear. So all I can say is, wow, what an unmitigated disaster. Where to even begin? Well, how about this? There is a right way to discover God, and there is a wrong way to discover God. The right way to discover God is to receive revelation from God. And the wrong way to discover God is to have imaginations about God. So the right way is revelation. The wrong way is our imagination. So let's first talk about revelation from God. What does the nation of Israel know about the Lord at this point in their walk? They've received the Ten Commandments, and commandment number one was the forbidding of the worship of other gods, and commandment number two was the forbidding of making carved images. So the forbidding of idols. They have violated both of those first two commandments, and they violated more, but we'll just deal with those for a moment. The nation, in their own opinion, truly believed that they were not in violation of the first commandment. This was not about the nation finding another God. That's very clear from the passage. Even Aaron agreed that, hey, it's not like we're totally abandoning Yahweh. They made a golden calf, sure, but that's just the face of God. That's just the image of God. They're still going to call it Yahweh. So they're still going to attach the name of God to it. And they're going to serve this calf based on information that they have received from God. So they're trying to be as spiritual as they can be about it. They tag the name of God to it. They credit it with being the God that led them out of Egyptian bondage. They're going to have a feast day to this thing. That's a Jewish method of worship. That's something that they've already known and learned. And the scriptures tell us that they're also going to offer burnt offerings and peace offerings to their God. And once again, those are Jewish methods of worship. That's all God stuff, as we would say. That is stuff that they already know about God. But at the end of the day, is it really Yahweh that they are serving? Or is it a god, little g, of their own creation that they are trying to pass off as the one true God? Well, we know the answer to that question. They're not looking for another god, but where they erred is trying to capture God and describe him with a carved image. J.L. Packer once said, metal images are the consequences of mental images. That is, we get the picture in our minds of what we want God to be, and then we carve that out. Maybe not literally, maybe not truly, especially in our day. We don't really do this as much, but you can see this in all sorts of subtle ways if you're paying really close attention. You'll hear people say, well, I hear what you're saying, but I don't really believe God is that way. When I think of God, they'll say, when I think of God, here's what I think of. Okay, that is trying to discover God with imagination instead of revelation that he already gave. When you do that, you end up with a false god, no matter what you name it, no matter how closely you try to link it to the worship of God. When you work outside of the prescribed manners of worship given by the Lord in the Word of God, you have missed the mark and you've ended up with a false god. And sadly, the really bad thing here, the heartbreaking thing here, is do you see the timing of all this? They're just days away. If they would have just waited a few days, they wouldn't have had to fill in all of the blanks they didn't know about the Lord. I mean, you can understand their desire that they want to know the Lord. They want to get moving on this. And there's all these blanks that they just don't know about God. And so here they are, just a few days shy of getting all of those answers and learning about how they can experience God. Just a few days shy of that, they start filling in the blanks themselves. And when you do that, you're selling out. You're selling out for convenience and speed, and you're missing out on true knowledge about God and true experience with God. It's a crime. Verse 7, and the Lord said to Moses, go, get down, because the people are already getting down, if you know what I mean. You don't know what I mean. Okay. So the Lord said to Moses, go, get down, for your... Listen, watch these words really closely. I want you to catch this. This is God speaking to Moses, and here's what he says to Moses, for your people, Moses, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. Moses, your people blew it big time. Verse 8, they have turned aside quickly out of the way which I have commanded them. That is so true. They have not been at this very long at all, and they have already left the path that the Lord was laying down for them. It's not been years since their Egyptian bondage. It's been weeks and months. That's it. So not far removed from that. They're already off of the straight and narrow. Reading on, they have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. Verse 9, and the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. I just love how God rats out the nation to Moses. Before Moses even goes down, he's still up there in his prayer time with the Lord, having that conversation. And the Lord reveals everything to Moses before he's even on the scene. And I just want to say, it's true. Pastors just know stuff. The Lord speaks to pastors. Those things you're trying to conceal, I already know about it. The Lord has already revealed it to me. So why don't you just go ahead and schedule the meeting and spill your guts? Okay, I really don't know, but I thought I'd try that. You can see why the Lord would be displeased here. The nation corrupted themselves. They strayed from the path. They made a false god. They worshiped it. They sacrificed to it. And they have even given it credit for the deliverance from Egyptian bondage. Now, I would have a problem with all of this if I was God, but I think that last one would especially strike a nerve with me. It would be like me, and this is a terrible example, I hate to even think about it, but it would be like me going home one day and finding another man in my home and listening to my wife explain to our friends that she's married to this man, this other loser. No, wait, that would make me a loser too. Well, I guess that fits. That she would be explaining to our friends that she's married to this guy, and then that she would tell our friends, hey, this guy, me and this guy, my husband, we helped to build this house. That just would not fly with me. It just would not work for another man to take my place and another person to get credit for what I've done. And that's the way the Lord sees it here. I think that was one of the things that really unnerved him here, was not just ingratitude, not just the nation being ungrateful, but the nation actually giving this false god credit for the miracles that the Lord did in order to purchase for them their deliverance. And I think in verse 9, God has really put his finger on the problem. Now, we looked at the sins up until verse 9, but in verse 9, I think the Lord has pinpointed the problem. Here's the problem. The nation is a stiff-necked nation. Now, before you get on your high horse about this, it's actually an unintended pun. This stiff-necked term is about horses. But before you get on your high horse about this, and look down on this Jewish nation for being stiff-necked, I just want to remind you that the Apostle Paul tells us to be very careful with this in Romans 11, chapter 11, verse 20. And in my own words, the Apostle Paul says, don't get too big for your own spiritual britches, because the Lord cast off the nation that didn't believe in him so that we Gentiles could be grafted in. So in other words, he's saying you could be plucked right out too. So read that verse, Romans chapter 11, verse 20, and calm yourself down, humble yourself, because it is not just like some moniker that only the Jews get. You shouldn't look at it this way. The Gentiles say, we're fine, we're not stubborn, we're not rebellious, but the Jews, they're stiff-necked. No, I think this goes for every human being in human flesh. We have some stiff-neckedness to us. You know what stiff-neckedness is? That's where it comes from, the experience of trying to break a horse to accept a rider or a guider, right? You got the reins around the horse, you got the straps, and when you or an ox or whatever the case may be, and when you pull the straps, when you pull the reins to the left or to the right, if that horse is broken, if that ox is broken, it'll go the direction you pull. But if it's not broken and it doesn't want to accept your control, it will stiffen its neck and then just keep doing what it wants to do. And when you yank back on those straps, it's supposed to stop, but it stiffens its neck and just keeps on going. It won't accept the control of the nation, or pardon me, it won't accept the control of God. That's what the nation is doing. It's a really good metaphor to explain the way the nation is, and it's a good metaphor to really explain the way so many are today in relation to the Lord. Verse 10, now therefore, let me alone. Moses, back off. Give me some space, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And I will make of you, Moses, a great nation. Wait a minute. This is huge. This is frightening. What the Lord is referring to is the promise that he gave to Abraham nearly half a dozen times in the book of Genesis. It was that promise that the nation that came from Abraham would flourish. It would become a massive nation, ultimately through the seed of that nation, the Christ, the Messiah, would be produced and bring about salvation for all. So as the New Testament refers to him, the book of Hebrews, Abraham was promised that he would be the father of faith. And do you realize that in verse 10, the Lord just said, Moses, what about if I scrap that? These people are a mess. What if I just toss them out? And what if I just start over with you? What if I give the promise of Abraham to you instead? And in the 20th century and the 21st century, they won't be singing, Father Abraham had many. So they'll be singing, Father Moses had many sons. So what do you think, Moses? Does that have a good ring for it? How about if I give you the promise? How about if we ditch the rest to Moses and you and I, we start right over? Was God serious here? Was this a real offer that he was giving to Moses? Some of us would be tempted by it. We'd say, absolutely, Lord. I always thought I was better than the rest of them. And I think you did a good job in picking. Let's go, Lord. But let's read on. Before we answer that question, let's read on and we'll answer it shortly. Verse 11, then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against, watch this, your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Isn't it hilarious how neither God nor Moses wants to claim the nation of Israel right now? They're playing hot potato with them. You take them, Moses. You led them out. No, Lord. You take them. You led them out. They're yours. No, they're yours. So hot potato with the nation of Israel. Verse 12, why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth? Lord, what would the heathen think if you did this to your people? How would that look to the pagan nations if you, the one true God, abandoned your holy chosen nation? And so Moses says, turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Verse 13. Remember Abraham. Lord, you made this promise to Abraham. You passed it down through Isaac and Israel, or Jacob. So he says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. Verse 14, so the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. So let's answer the question. Plan A didn't seem to go too well. It seems like the Lord has reverted to plan B. Is this a legitimate plan B? Was this offer to Moses really valid? The answer is no. No. God was never actually going to do this. God is not like people. God doesn't vacillate or evolve or change. He never changes his mind. He never goes back on his promises. When God says it, he does it. I give you some verses real quick if you want to jot them down. James chapter 1, verse 17. Every good and perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Malachi chapter 3, verse 6, or if you're Italian, Malachi chapter 3, verse 6. For I am the Lord, I do not change. I am the Lord, I do not change. So what God is doing here is he is making a threat and not a decree. It is not a valid, legitimate offer. What he is doing is he is testing his servant. This is the same thing that parents do with their children when they bring home the new pet from the pet store and the kids are fighting, scratching, scraping, arguing over that new pet. What does the parent say? The parent says, well, maybe I should just take it back to the pet store. And when the parent does that, it fixes the problem, doesn't it? It's right about then that the kids learn, you know what? It is more important to have that pet to love than it is to try to win out in my quarrel against my sibling. And that is sort of what we're seeing take place. It is something that the Lord is developing within Moses. Moses has had and will continue to have his fair share of squabbles and arguments and struggles with the nation of Israel. They blame him for everything. Everything that goes wrong, it's Pastor Moses' fault. Pharaoh said, no, we can't go. Moses' fault. There's bitter water at Marah. Moses' fault. We're pinned down at the Red Sea and the Egyptians are coming. Moses' fault. So this is a constant method of coping for the nation to just hammer Moses, to just beat up on Moses, and to attack Moses for every problem that they feel like goes wrong within the nation. But Moses, when it comes down to it, when the rubber meets the road, when the chips are down, and Moses has his chance to get out from underneath this ungrateful, rebellious, argumentative, and hostile nation that's constantly fighting him and challenging his authority, what does he do instead? He realizes that having the love of God and the experience of God within the nation is far more important than those little squabbles. And what the Lord is actually doing is he is developing, he's creating in Moses a heart of intercessory, a heart of intercession, I should say. He's creating an intercessor in Moses. That is an important foundation for the nation moving forward. And he's not just creating the intercessor Moses, but he's also laying down a type for us that will be fulfilled in the New Testament by Jesus, our intercessor. But this appeal that Moses brings to God, I think, is very well done. Just let me hit this kind of quick here. Here's his appeal to God. Verse 11, God, though we're arguing about this, they really are your people. Lord, they're your people. Verse 12, God, this is your reputation that is on the line. And verse 13, God, this is your promise that is at stake. These are your people. This is your reputation. These are your promises. So Moses is counseling the Lord. The thought is laughable, but you just got to go along with it. Moses is counseling the Lord. Lord, please don't abandon your people. Don't ruin your reputation. Don't break your promises to the nation. Lord, they messed up, but don't you mess up. And the Lord goes, okay, you're right, Moses. And I'm glad you saved me from making a mistake. We'll do it your way, wink, wink. See, this is what the Lord was leading this. The Lord was producing this in Moses. It feels like Moses' idea. But the Lord was testing Moses because the Lord was working this deep love for the nation within him. And the Lord was raising him up as an intercessor for the nation. Verse 15, and Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. The tablets were written on both sides. On the one side and on the other, they were written. Did you know that? Most people don't know that because they've seen the movies, and Charlton Heston comes down with the two tablets, and they're one-sided. But this verse tells us that the material God gave, the law that God gave, was four tablets worth of material. So the Lord did Moses a favor, and he made these two tablets double-sided. Why? So he wouldn't have to carry four tablets down the mountain. He's almost 81 years old at this point, and the Lord cuts him some slack and prints these on both sides. Verse 16, now the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God, engraved on the tablets. 17, and when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there is a noise of war in the camp. Verse 18, but he said, that is Moses said, it is not the noise of the shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat. Joshua, this isn't war that you're hearing, but it is the sound of singing I hear. Now, back in Exodus chapter 24, we were told that Moses went up the mountain to be with the Lord on day one, and he took Joshua as his assistant. He took Joshua with him. No doubt he's going to make use of that, and Joshua is carrying at least one of these stones on the way down. But at some point, Joshua stops where he is, and Moses continues up onto the mountain, further up, to be with the Lord alone. Joshua is not privy to this conversation between Moses and the Lord. And in that sense, Joshua becomes a much better example for us than Aaron, because Joshua was just sort of ditched there halfway or three-quarter up the mountain. He spent nearly 40 days on his own, probably wondering the same thing about Moses that the nation was. Where is he? Is he still alive? And yet we don't see Joshua making farm-based gods, idols. We don't see him panicking or growing impatient. Oh, I want to know what God is like. I just can't wait. I'll make it up. You don't see that from Joshua. But Aaron's down below with the company of all the people. And look at how royally Aaron messes things up. So, when Joshua hears the ruckus below, because he has not yet been told what was going on, the Lord told Moses, but Moses hasn't shared that with Joshua. So when he hears the noise below, he thinks that the nation is under attack. He thinks he's hearing the drums of war. No, he's not hearing the drums of war. He's hearing the speakers of the DJ. He's hearing the music. And there's partying going on. And there's dancing taking place. And just a quick point here. I just want to add, that's sort of the same way as jewelry, isn't it? You're going to read about good partying in the Bible. You're going to read about good dancing in the Bible. Look at Luke chapter 15, verses 23 through 25. When the prodigal son returns, it says this: "Bring the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they begin to be merry. They're having a party here. They're celebrating. Verse 25, "Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near the house, he heard," what? "Music and dancing." And there wasn't a thing wrong with it in this passage. It was neutral at least, holy at best. Holy in the sense that it's teaching us a spiritual lesson. Here's some holy dancing for you. That is King David in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 14. There he is dancing before the Lord. Should I have more clothes on? Granted, I'll give that to you. But he was dancing before the Lord, and the Lord loved it. So dancing, partying, all of those things, it just depends on our heart. Why are we doing it? Are we having our parties because we're celebrating things that the Lord would be okay with? Are we dancing because we're incorporating that into our worship? The Lord would be pleased with it. But if we're partying and dancing for sensual reasons, for fleshly reasons, now the Lord is going to have a problem with it. And of course, that is the kind of dancing and partying that is going on down below here in Exodus chapter 32. Verse 19, "So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing." You know, he hears the party's happening, the strobe lights are flashing. "So it says, Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain." Oh no, that's the first edition, autographed by God. 10 commandments, 2 tablets of stone, totally destroyed. But I think it's poetic because Moses broke them because the nation had broke them. Verse 20, "Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, and ground it to powder, and he scattered it on the water and made the children of Israel drink it." Golden calf shakes for all. That would make them violently ill. You're just not, even if it's in powder form, you're just not supposed to intake that level of heavy metals. I would suspect they were barfing for days. And I think serves them right. Good for them. They made the Lord sick by what they were doing. So turn about is fair play. The Lord's making them sick through Moses. Keep in mind, Moses just went up there and heard the Lord's law, which basically centers around this one principle, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. I think Moses is thinking, barf for barf. You made the Lord sick, it's your turn. Verse 21. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you, Aaron, that you have brought so great a sin upon them? Now, it is true, all the people did evil. And Aaron didn't come up with this on his own. They approached him with this. Wasn't his idea. Wouldn't happen if this was just up to Aaron. But the people brought this idea to him. They brought this suggestion to him. And sure, Aaron did compromise, but he wasn't the ringleader on this. Nonetheless, it doesn't matter. Where does the buck stop? Who has to do the answering for it? Aaron. Why? Because Aaron is leadership. Moses left Aaron in charge of the nation, so it's Aaron that is responsible for every single bit of this. He's the one that has to answer for it. And that is a sober lesson for anyone that would desire positions of leadership among God's people. Those positions of leadership, that authority that is given to you, also comes with great responsibility and accountability to God. And that is a fearful thing. That's why the New Testament warns us, you know, not every one of you should desire to be teachers, because with that position comes greater condemnation when you're leading people astray. Boy, has Aaron done that or what? Verse 22, so Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. You know what they're like, Moses, come on. Verse 23, for they said to me, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. It just happened. Voila. Abracadabra. First, let's get this out of the way. Aaron is absolutely lying here. Aaron is lying through his golden grill right now. We've known since verse 4 that Aaron was far more involved in this than he was trying to let on to Moses. He didn't want Moses to know just how involved he was. But there in verse 4, we read it. It was Aaron that said, bring your gold. It was Aaron that threw it in the pot, the oven, to melt it down. It was Aaron that sculpted this thing. It says he used the engraver's tool. He sculpted this calf. It was his creation. Whether that's directly or whether he's overseeing it, this was all Aaron. Why would he choose a calf? That's dumb. Why would you worship a baby cow? I'll tell you why. It was a popular idol in the nation of Egypt. The people were familiar with the golden calf. They were comfortable with it. They were used to it. So what Aaron has done is he has compromised. He's letting them keep some of the past religion, some of the past influence, and Aaron figures, well, we're not going to just completely abandon the system that is started. We'll just incorporate some of those things. We'll compromise, and we'll try to make it work in this new religious system that the Lord is building. It quite literally is the very first attempt at being seeker sensitive. You're all aware of the seeker sensitive movement, right? Now that's been a popular thing for years now, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot of good points in that. Even one of our core values here at Anchored Fellowship is that because times change and people change, methods are going to change. We just want to make sure the message doesn't change. We're not so much worked up about how we do things, or, you know, what we're using for seats or what we're putting on. We're more concerned about the message. However, this can be taken to an extreme, this desire to be seeker sensitive, this desire for churches to be accepted, popular, and culturally relevant. And unfortunately, sometimes churches do that at the abandonment of the clear teaching and clear doctrines of the Bible. It's like the preacher and deacon that went hunting one day, and they went where the preacher always went and hunted. He had permission to hunt there, so he goes to the farmer. He tells the deacon, you know, before we hunt, I do this every year, but let's just make sure I'll get permission again today. So he goes to the farmer and he says, hey, is it okay if me and the deacon hunt on your property today? And the farmer says, well, of course, absolutely, no problem, anytime. But could you do me a favor? Since you got your gun on you, I got a horse that needs put down. I don't know why we're talking so much about horses tonight. I got a horse that needs put down. Would you mind putting him down for me? And the pastor, being a manly guy, says, sure, of course, I'll put him down for you. Well, as he's walking back to the deacon, he gets this brilliant idea that he's going to have a little fun with the deacon. He's not going to tell the deacon that he's supposed to shoot this one horse. So he goes to the deacon and he says, the deacon asks him, well, what did he say? Are we allowed to hunt on his property? And the pastor said, no, I'm sorry. I don't know what got into him, but he said we're not allowed to hunt on his property. But you know what? I'm going to teach him a lesson. He walks over there, points his gun at the horse, and boom, and he kills the horse. And just then the deacon says, yes, and he shoots the other three and says, now let's get out of here before we get in trouble. And see, that happens a lot. Well, not that exactly. I don't know that that's ever really happened. But that sort of thing happens in church ministry because we as leaders feel like we want to be relevant and loved and accepted by the culture. We want to try to limit any language barriers between us and the world. So we become so much like the world in the things that we say, the quotes that we make, the things that we reference. And what ultimately ends up happening is we have the exact opposite of the desired effect. We're not leading people to the church. We're leading people further into the world, because the people in the seats will say, well, if the deacon does that, if the deacon says those things, well, then it must be okay for me. If the pastor is watching that and listening to that, well, then it must be okay with me. And unfortunately, we can lead others as they see our example into worldly things that ultimately bring about their spiritual demise and wreck their walk with the Lord. We must be so careful, so very careful. Now, We begin to see why it is that God didn't pick Aaron instead of Moses. It's pretty clear right about now, isn't it? You could wonder about that. Because remember, God called Moses to be the mouthpiece for himself. And what was the first thing Moses said? I'm not a good speaker. So God, okay, he moves to Moses' brother, Aaron, and he says, Aaron will be your spokesman. You following that? Moses is God's spokesperson. He's God's mouthpiece. But because he doesn't like to speak, now Aaron is going to be Moses' mouthpiece so that Moses can be God's mouthpiece. You see what kind of mess that is? So you figure, why wouldn't he just cut out the middleman? Here's why. Moses may not have been good at speaking. Maybe Aaron was better at that. But here's what we're learning already. Moses was better at hearing and obeying. And that's more important to the Lord when it comes to a leader. Aaron made a fine number two. You're not really seeing that right now. You got to wait that out. You got to let him develop. He'll make a fine number two, but not a good number one. Moses is the far better number one. The Lord knew what he was doing when he chose Moses. So here's Aaron's excuse. And I think we're going to have to just finish with this. Here's Aaron's excuse. Verse 22. Don't be mad, Moses. You know how these people are. They're messed up. You know that. They're evil, he says. And they just wanted to get things going because, frankly, we were all a little concerned about you, Moses. We didn't know what happened to you. So we took our gold, we threw it in the oven. Out came a god, a calf. And we just all thought, wow, it was a miracle from God. And that, Moses, is my story, and I'm sticking to it. And fine, Aaron, that may be your story, but that is not the truth. And he knew it. I'm going to ask you to stand and we will, I guess, finish this up next week. Oh, we were so close. But we can just take our good, sweet time with the rest of it next week. Let's pray.